It's 14:28.
We will call the Health and Human Services Budget Division together for Wednesday, April 15th. We have a big agenda for today. We'll get as far as we can in the morning. We are having some issues, as is usual for this time of year, trying to get fiscal notes so that we can do our job as a finance committee. So we'll have to be a little bit fluid and take things as they're available. I think that we're going to be jumping around the agenda a little bit. The first two bills, I think we're going to be taking Senator Westrom's at the table right now. I think we'll be taking Senator Goodwin next. Those two are for sure ready, and we'll move on as bills become ready. So with that, Senate File 1428, Senator Westrom, welcome to the committee.
Hey, Senator Laurie, members, thank you for the opportunity to present Senate File 1428. Members, real briefly, I know time is always a crunch this time, but this bill would allocate $85,000 to Stearns County, part of county in my eight-county district. I represent the western half of Stearns County. Here today with me is their social services director, and I'll let him, Mark, talk a little bit more about this specifically and why the expense is unique to Stearns County. But specifically, there is a relatively new veterans, returning veterans home and housing option known as the Eagles Healing Nest in Sauk Center, western Stearns County, but in my Senate district. And it is a private nonprofit, and they have taken an old site that the state used to own, reformatory for juveniles, and it has several buildings that were set up for housing back in the day. The state had abandoned and sold that off about 10, 15 years ago, and this organization with a real passion to serve veterans suffering from PST, post-traumatic stress disorder, or other just reunification, reintegration into civilization after they've done tours overseas, whatever struggles they might be facing in their family, just getting jobs, trying to wrestle with, that is the service and the purpose of the Eagles Healing Nest. Well, the reason for the bill in front of you is it does bring an extraordinary higher load of paperwork and veterans processing to that county above what many counties and most counties would see because of this unique opportunity and great facility that we have in Sauk Center known as the Eagles Healing Nest. But Mark will discuss a little bit of the extra cost that they see because of this opportunity that we have to serve veterans, but it does bring the load workload a little higher to Stearns County. And so with that, Mr. Chair, I'll let Mark introduce himself and give you a brief background on and reason for the bill.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and provide your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Mark Sizer. I'm the Human Services Administrator for Stearns County. In Stearns County, Human Services provides all the correctional services, public health services, and social services. Veterans Services is a separate department provided by our Veterans Services Office. I want to thank you for this opportunity to speak to the committee. As Senator Westrom noted, Eagles Healing Nest opened in Sauk Center approximately 3 years ago. There are some unique features of this facility. One is the size of the facility. Most GRH facilities are 2 to 8 beds. The facility currently has about 70 residents. They are in the process of looking at opening a fourth building and a capacity eventually of 200 residents. Also, something that's unique is many of the residents are from out of Stearns County, and they also serve out-of-state individuals that have moved to the facility. And a third item is that most, if not all, of the staff are volunteer staff. In fact, I am not aware of any paid staff at the facility. It's a peer support model where veterans are helping veterans, those that have been in residence a longer period of time and have stabilized, take on a leadership role in assisting in running that facility. I'd just like to briefly mention four areas that Stearns County is pretty heavily involved in providing services to Eagles Healing Nest. The first is financial assistance, and you know the whole plethora of programs in the financial assistance area, but group residential housing is an example I'll give you. Annually, it's costing us about $11,392 to provide services to Eagles Healing Nest. Financial workers conduct the initial interviews, gather the documentation. If the client is eligible for GRH, the monthly task is involved of approving and releasing those funds and case managing those cases. The next area is providing social services. This is about a $15,000 cost annually to the county. Many of the residents have chemical dependency concerns, mental health concerns, and other issues that our social services provides interventions and services to assist them with. Case plans are developed for clients. Detox services have been used. The daily rate in Stearns County for the county is about $340 a day for those services. And services are provided also for vulnerable adult protection, civil commitment, and disabilities. The third is providing correctional services, and this is probably the most intensive and is the most expensive. It's $59,000 a year. A number of the residents are under some form of pretrial, supervision, probation, or supervised release supervision. And in the past year, we've had an average of 15 to 16 of these individuals at the Eagles Healing Nest. Many of these clients are supervised on high risk. We have a felony repeat domestic violence court. We also have a drug court. And we have surveillance technicians and probation officers that are spending quite a bit of time at Eagles Healing Nest providing those services. Finally is the providing veterans benefit services at a cost of about $3,500 annually. We have veteran services officers that go to Eagles Healing Nest. They also have an outreach office in Melrose, and they provide those determinations of benefits. Some cases are very simple and straightforward, but as you can imagine, people coming from out of state or out of county, finding those records can be quite laborious, and they spend a lot of time doing that. Those are the costs. Totaling just about $89,000 a year, and the bill is a request for $85,000 to help offset the cost to Stearns County to provide these services. Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I'd be happy to try to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Sizer. Are there any questions of members? I'm told there's another individual who would like to testify. Mr. Is that correct, Senator Westrom?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. A gentleman from the Eagles Healing Nest, just to give you a real brief perspective from their facility standpoint, if they want to come up here, if there's any questions.
For questions? Senator
Fishbach?
I'll
just let him talk briefly, if that's all right, Mr. Chair. You do need to introduce yourself for the record.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and provide your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Bruce Sabota, and I spend a lot of time up at the Eagles Healing Nest. I'm from Clearwater, Minnesota, and I started helping out up there 2 years ago, and I've watched the place grow. I've watched veterans really be relieved at coming in from different parts of the country and coming there and find out that they do have a home and they can open up. And I've seen a lot of cases where it's really helping them. They open up from vets to vets talking. They got different programs up there that help them. It's a 125 acre parcel, and it's got a farm or got the barn on there, and vets go for that. And they do all their own cooking, cleaning, landscaping, mowing the grass. I think it's just a great place for the vets, and whatever help we could get would be wonderful. Like they like I said, it's all volunteers up there right now running it. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Sabota.
Good morning. My name is Mike Spody.
Welcome to the committee. Mike Spody. Thank
yep,
you.
I'm from St. Cloud. My wife and I both volunteer up at the Eagle Ceiling Nest. She does a lot of the secretarial stuff. She does a lot of the secretarial work for the GRH guys. I do a lot of the volunteer work on the buildings. Those buildings have been sitting empty since probably 1999. They do need a lot of renovation, but the guys themselves come in and do a lot of the work. A lot of volunteers, a lot of the guys do a lot of work. It's not, I've seen the guys thrive up there because this isn't an institution. I mean, you don't go in and do your program and go sit down someplace and do nothing else for the rest of the day. They've all got their chores. They've all got to do something. They get to go out. They get to move around. And they really enjoy that. It's not like they're just being institutionalized and just sit there and be, you know, like a hospital situation. They're able to get out. They're able to go around. They got to do all their chores. They got to do the yard work. They got to take care of the animals. They work on the buildings. They take care of themselves, basically. So it's all volunteer, and it's all run on donations so far, except now with the, hopefully with the GRH gets a little more funding. They would like to fund, I know Melanie would like to fund a full-time nurse. What they've got there now is a volunteer nurse, and he is looking for a full-time position somewhere else. And they would like to be able to fund a full-time nurse with the increase in the funding. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Spody. Senator Westrum.
Mr. Chair, just to wrap up, the bill for this $85,000 would be for the county to help with the extra cost in processing GRH funding and request.
Right.
And there's a lot of paperwork that goes with it, but in them being able to do that, it helps out the facility tremendously because for the ones that do qualify, it helps cover some of those costs. As you've heard, this is a great organization based on a lot of volunteers and donations, and you can imagine the financial costs that go with something like this. And so every angle that they can have some assistance helps enhance their volunteers and their donations that they're able to put towards other things. 70 veterans are with a home and thriving because of the Eagle's Healing Nest right here in central Minnesota.
Thank you for bringing this forward, Senator Westrum. Any questions of members? Seeing none, is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to offer testimony either in support or opposition to Senate File 1428? Seeing none, Senator Fischbach moves Senate File 1428 be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS Omnibus Finance Bill. Any further discussion on that? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Westrum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee.
Next, we'll be taking up Senator Goodwin, Senate File 775, and then we did just get word that we will be ready with Senate File 1071, Senator Wieger. There's no fiscal from DHS, which was the open question that we had. We've resolved that question, so if folks interested in that one can get ready to be on deck. Senator Goodwin, Senate File 775, welcome to the committee. You have an amendment, I understand, as well.
Thank
two
you,
amendments?
Mr. Chair and members. Yeah, we have two amendments.
Okay.
Do you want us to explain the amendments before we...
Well, let me pull this out and see where we're at. We're on a first engrossment, so it's not a author's amendment.
A2
is in our packet, and we have an A3 that's being handed out right now. So, and the fiscal note is drafted to the A3 that is being handed out. And the, okay, so maybe you should describe the bill and you know, how the fiscal note plays with the amendments. It looks like the A2 is changing effective dates probably to align with the fiscal note as well. Is that correct? So this is that new MMB rule we're getting quite familiar with. So Senator Franzen moves the A2 amendment to adopt the timelines that are needed to implement this. Any questions on that? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. So we have those. The A3 looks a little bit, there's more words anyway. Is that that I haven't seen until just now, but Senator Goodwin.
Yes, I'd like to have Melinda explain that amendment because I just saw it as well.
Sure. Ms. Hugdahl, did you have?
I do, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Melinda Hugdahl from Legal Aid. This 775 is work from the Child Custody Dialogue Group that many of you have heard about and has been working on a package of bills. Several of the bills were policy-only bills, and those have been heard by committees and are on the floor. We had another bill that dealt with the parent expense adjustment with child support purposes. There were some concerns with that bill and some issues with how the changes that we were talking about doing were working. So everybody has been trying to see if we could fix them on our own, quickly discovered we needed some more help and some more time. So the A3 amendment really just sets forth a mechanism for folks to get together and keep talking over the interim. It also has an appropriation, and the amount is in the fiscal note from the department. For an economist, the department, I know, has had discussions with the economist who helped us do the original guidelines to help us kind of make sure the idea we want to do can work with our own guidelines. So
this is an $8,000 economist. It's not too bad. I don't.
Mr. Chair, in the other chamber, I was told that we actually have the lowest fiscal note in their committee for this this approach. So that's the gist of the amendment. It's a mechanical piece to really kind of keep this idea moving forward, which we're all committed to working on over the interim.
Members have questions on the A3 amendment to bring it in line with the fiscal note we have before us. Seeing none, Senator Franzen moves the A3 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. And we'll just assume that the blank appropriation on line 110 is filled in accordance with the fiscal note for that, just for the record. And then, so on the bill, we have the fiscal note. Did you have more to add to the bill in terms of description, or is that?
Just a little.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just so we know that this is a bill that's in a package of bills on the child custody issue, which has been contentious around here, but the group met over the summer and fall and have come up with a series of bills that are all have a consensus agreement on the issues from all of the groups involved. So they did some good work and came to some good conclusions and got some things in there that that everybody did agree on. I'm just going to quickly talk about the five. There's five sections to the bill, and I'll just briefly explain that, and then Melinda can, Ms. Hugdahl can go on with the rest of the explanation. She knows the details very well since she served on the dialogue group. So the first section in 775 concerns the form a father can sign to establish paternity, and this form is called the recognition of parentage. There's more on that, but I'm going to go on to the next item is the definition of the word obligor, which changes from the parent without primary physical custody to the one obligated to pay support. The third item relates to how a judge might determine potential income for a parent not at the time working. So this changes from to determine child support from full-time at 150% of federal state minimum wage to 30 hours at 100% of minimum wage, which seems more in line with reality, especially since the changes in minimum wage and the frequency that lower-paid jobs today are only offered for 30 hours per week. The fourth section is item adds another piece to the deviation section of child support provisions. So this one gives more possible deviation should there be a significant disparity of income between the parents. If one parent has substantially less income than the other parent but has 10 to 45% parenting time, it would not be in the best interest of the child to require that parent provide child support payments. So this gives the judge flexibility on that issue. The final item concerns reporting to a consumer credit reporting agency when an obligor is in arrears for 3 months of payments. This section is good because it makes sure that there is notification to the obligor 30 days in advance that the child support payments that this reporting doesn't have a negative impact on the parent's long-range ability to get basic things like housing, employment, or buying a car, things important to provide for a child. So this clarifies the opportunity to pay the arrears and prevent the negative report on one's credit rating. And from that, I'll ask if you have questions first and allow Ms. Hugdahl to go into any detail.
Ms. Hugdahl, did you have changes. Additional testimony or just for questions?
Just very briefly, on the recognition of parentage pieces, largely so folks are aware, these are things that have been in case law for some time. We're really just moving them in so that people on the form and asking the department to look at the form to make sure people really understand what they're signing and what it does and doesn't do under case law. So that's really the gist of the recognition. The credit bureau piece is a federal requirement already. There's just no statute about it, so we're codifying that. And also, if someone's paying on their agreement, we want to make sure that some kind of positive message is transmitted to credit bureau, which isn't happening now. And the other piece is just to note that the potential income, which is Section 4, is also in the governor's budget as well.
Okay. Are these costs reflected in the governor's budget as well? This cost that we have on the fiscal note before us, or some portion of that?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm looking back at Ms. Olson from the department who is here. I would think that at least the potential income change would be reflected in the governor's budget because it's
Sounds
included.
Like it.
So that piece of the fiscal cost would be included, and I'm sorry I don't have that page in front of me to tell you exactly what that number is, but...
Well, thank you for flagging that. We'll get behind it and make sure that we don't, you know, book it twice on the spreadsheet.
Right.
Any questions of members? Seeing none, is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to offer testimony either in support or opposition to Senate File 775? Seeing none, we might have a little bit of additional information.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Ms. Olson advised me on page 12 of the fiscal note at the top. There is a cost in here about Section 3 of the bill requires system changes. This is the potential income, and it looks like there are some costs at the end of that sentence about the state share, the estimated fiscal cost. So that would be the, I think, relevant portion where the portion that's in our bill would, I guess, be reflected also in the governor's budget pages at the top of page 12.
So the $56,000 state share would be included in the governor's budget proposal in the balance of the costs?
That's my understanding.
Or the $56,000 plus the $6,000 annual, I would say?
Yeah.
What do you say, 56?
56 that's is the state
cost.
Share.
Oh.
And ongoing maintenance costs. So to get the system updated is $56,000 one time state share, and that would be reflected in the governor's budget, plus $6,000 a year ongoing costs, which would also be incorporated in the governor's budget. And the balance of what we see on this fiscal note would be in this proposal only. Is that? I am seeing nodding of head. So
yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes, that's my understanding in talking with Ms. Olson that's from the department that's how it is. Thank you.
That's helpful. So I think we have what we need. We've asked for testimony. Nobody came forward. We're ready for a motion. Senator Hayden moves Senate File 775 as amended be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. On that motion, let me just say real quick, thank you for your work on this. I do know this is a very difficult issue to work through, and finding five things that everybody can agree to is no small feat, and I really do want to thank you for your work on this. On Senator Hayden's motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Goodwin. Senate File 1071, Senator Wieger. Members, there's an A5 in your packet that can be disregarded, as can the bill. You can read what the bill was, but we have an A6, which has been recently agreed to with the parties, and you know, there's still not in perfect alignment, but I think there's been tremendous progress, and we do have the fiscal. We have the departments ready to tell us what the fiscal is on this. DHS has signed off and said that there will be no fiscal cost for DHS, and the fiscal cost for MDH is only in the appropriation. So with that, we have what we need to hear the bill in finance. Senator Wieger, maybe you can enlighten us a little further.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair, division members. Senate File 1071 basically addresses the need for violence prevention plans in hospitals. We had a great deal of testimony, which most of you heard in policy committee, regarding the need. We'll highlight that need shortly with a few testifiers. The bill, as amended and incorporated in the spirit of the new amendment, would provide that hospitals develop a violence prevention plan, be January 15 of 2016. This would be in collaboration with the employees. A key component as well is training of employees. And then another provision that's very important is that there would be an allowance to have reporting to law officials. I have Chief Paul Schnell from Maplewood to underscore the importance of that. So those would be a few of the key components, and I want to commend the Nurses Association, the Hospital Association, others that have put together what I think is a workable compromise. So with that, if I could ask testifiers to give some brief comments and then open it up for any questions.
Excellent. And maybe just to have the amendment before us, I'll have Senator Hayden moves the A6 amendment. We won't take action on it, but so it's properly before us for discussion. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record, whoever wishes to start.
Good morning, Chairperson Lori and members of the committee. My name is Nurse Nora Jordan. I've been a registered nurse in the emergency department at Sanford Bemidji Medical Center since 2012, and previously worked in a chemical dependency center. I'm on a work restriction due to an injury sustained on September 29, 2014. I was caring for a patient who was having a suspected prescription medication overdose. She later told me that she had been using heroin. She was getting more and more unsteady while she was in the emergency department, and she was getting paranoid and would not stay seated or lay down, unsteadily pacing around the room. We moved her to a different room for better visibility and removed the mattress on the floor for her protection. She didn't want to get on the mattress even when we redirected her, all the while becoming more verbally abusive to the 5 staff who were now taking turns, including myself, giving her one-on-one care. She eventually grabbed a phone and the cord and looked like she was going to use it as a weapon against another nurse. I came in and tried to restrain her. The other nurse went for help. I tried to lower her face down to the mattress. She flipped over instead. She was swinging, hitting me, scratching me, spitting, pinching, anything she could do to lash out at me. Finally, 2 more nurses and a security guard came in. We got her flipped over onto her stomach. We asked for a chemical restraint. We asked the security guard for handcuffs to restrain her and for law enforcement to come. The police came. It took 3 officers to handcuff her, put on ankle shackles and a spit mask, and then 3 officers carried her out in the horizontal position. As a result, I've sustained a serious back injury to my sciatic nerve, which is giving me pain even as I sit here with you. As I said, I'm on a work restriction. I can't lift more than 20 pounds, which is something every nurse has to do and is expected to do in the course of their job. At my facility, we have what's considered, it's called MOAB training. It's Management of Aggressive Behavior. It's mandatory training for all nurses. I think we have to be recertified either yearly or, excuse me, every 2 years. But it's not something that we practice with staff. Also, in the last week, I learned that my facility does have two things in place, one called behavioral rapid response, and also show of force, neither of which I've ever heard of. I don't know anything about them, point being that they're, and I actually asked several nurses this week, have you ever heard of that? And they haven't. So although the policy is in place, we're not familiar with it. I finally got approval on my workman's comp claim March 13th, allowing for 4 weeks of physical therapy. That's 7 months since the injury. I've learned that this time frame may soon be considered the norm. We need a preparedness plan that includes all the necessary staff to subdue patients who become violent. We need to have a plan that makes sure that I can get the people I need to protect not just myself, but my patients as well. It's even more important that the members of the preparedness team know what to do when they come to an incident. It should be mandatory that facilities have that plan and review it and rehearse it regularly. Then we can react effectively. I understand that there are some people who just want to make assaulting a nurse a felony. And because my incident happened in the emergency department, that patient was convicted of a felony. But that doesn't take away my injury. That didn't prevent her from assaulting me, nor did it provide the support I needed when I needed it. It's not a deterrent when a patient isn't of sound mind during the situation, which is often the case. What I'm asking of you today is to support policies that prepare and prevent workplace violence and make sure that we have the trained staff we need when we need it. Thank you for your time and attention today and for allowing me to share my story.
Thank you, Ms. Jordan. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Paul Schnell. I'm the Chief of Police for the City of Maplewood. I want to first acknowledge all the work that has been done by all the parties to bring this bill together. As a representative of local law enforcement in a community where just last fall an act of significant violence occurred in our local hospital, resulting in serious injury to nursing staff. As law enforcement, we want to partner with our local hospitals and the healthcare workers in them. We regard them as critical to the health and viability of our community. We know that there is significant underreporting of these incidents by healthcare workers and healthcare facilities across our nation. We also know that the criminal justice system is not the answer to address these issues. I value being able to work with our local hospital, and we enjoy a great relationship. Our joint planning efforts have certainly increased in light of the recent incident that occurred just this last fall. I want to lend a voice to the discussion with regard to reporting. In policing, public reporting of incidents is viably and critically important for the engagement of our community. Similar, the Federal Clery Act governing education reporting required that schools, higher education institutions report both to the U.S. Department of Education as well as publish that data on a regular basis in their college community. What this has been helpful to is development of really good prevention and intervention and response plans. While I can't speak on behalf of my colleagues across Minnesota, I can't imagine that there would be an agency, a law enforcement agency, that would not welcome both knowing the extent to which local workers are being assaulted or harmed in our local hospital or healthcare facilities, but more importantly, I can't imagine a modern law enforcement agency that would not want to be part of prevention and intervention planning for the safety and welfare of our community and the workers who serve our communities. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Schnell. Looks like we
that
have.
That concludes our we have presentation. Mr. Tollefson's here. And
Mr. Tollefson, did you have
others that
testimony
could speak?
Or?
Well, Mr. Chair,
Mr. Tollefson.
My name is John Tollefson with the Minnesota Nurses Association, and I was asked previously if I could walk through some of the changes of the bill, but of course, if you prefer not to do that, then that's fine.
No, that's fine.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. We appreciate the work that the hospital administrators and the Minnesota Hospital Association have done with us to come to an agreement that we have before you now. And it really, the main differences are that reporting is taken away from the Department of Health and kept internal to the hospital. So they still prepare the data on the number of acts of violence that occur each year, along with the unit in which the incident occurred and any injuries sustained. But then that data is kept internally for the review of the committee. The bill requires that be reviewed annually, along with the effectiveness of the report. And it is shared with local law enforcement and, if there are any union representatives of that hospital, with those representatives. However, it does not go outside. And that's the one sticking point that remains in our discussions is where the reporting could go that would be in a way that wouldn't embarrass the hospitals or anything like that. That's certainly not the intent, but where we could still monitor as a public, as a patient's right to know, as the public's right to know, the assaults that are occurring against healthcare workers in their local hospitals. And so we want to come to a resolution on that before the bill is finalized, but what you have before you is the language that's been agreed to thus far, and that's the one remaining sticking point. But it does keep training in place and the other aspects that are important.
A preparedness plan.
And the plan being the biggest part.
Yep. Ms. Krenke, did you have testimony as well?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mary Krenke, and I'm with the Minnesota Hospital Association. And I do think that this language reflects much of our work to date. I do want to clarify just a couple things, if I can. I think it's important to recognize that violence is not just happening in hospitals. It's happening also in our nursing home settings, in our clinics, and also in home care. And people often forget about the home care setting, and that can actually be one of the more dangerous settings to provide health care. And I think it's important to recognize that the hospitals are stepping up here saying, we're going to go first. We'll be the first to say that we're committed to doing violence prevention plans, and we're willing to do this first. And for that, I'd like for people to recognize that we need a little time to get these plans in place and to give us some flexibility to work internally without a lot of burden of reporting to a state entity. The second thing I'd like to make a point of is that measuring progress is not necessarily about the number of incidences that occur. And I know that sounds strange, but you could have a hospital that has made terrific progress putting all of this in place and preparing their employees, and they could still have an act of violence. And another hospital might not have done much at all, and they could get by without any acts of violence. So I want us to be very careful and recognize that this is a commitment to improving the readiness of our employees. This is about a commitment to make our workplaces safer, but that doesn't mean that an incident is not going to happen. So just reporting a number in and of itself has not made your facility any safer at all. And it, in some ways, diverts our attention to the training that needs to happen internally. So,
thank you, Ms. Krenke. And thank you to both the Nurses Association and the Hospital Association for your serious work on this. This bill has been a topic of conversation for quite some time, and it has undergone significant revisions during the legislative session. And I think that we're very close. I understand that there's one or two sticking points, and I applaud the work you've done so far, and hopefully we can have something that everyone thinks really moves us forward. With that, any questions of members on the A6 amendment? Senator Sharon.
Really not a question, just that I'll accept this because the stakeholders have worked on trying to find a common ground here. But I do believe that this reporting issue is not going to go away for me, because it is the numbers that give us trend lines. And if we can see those much more visibly as a state, then we can engage and insist on activity to resolve workplace violence. Our other experience with this, remember, in the legislature is with the state-operated services where the numbers are visible. And it's because they are visible that we're paying attention to it and trying to create an environment in which people that we're asking to do this work are retained as safe. So it's not about embarrassing anybody. It's not about assuming that it's only in this place that violence occurs. It is about having the data we need to make sure that we're creating safe work environments. So I'm not satisfied with this, although I will support it because it's moving the process forward.
Thank you, Senator Sharon. Senator Rosen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Senator Weaker, I think you've done an amazing job with moving this forward. I guess I feel that the data is there has been a lot of movement in that area, and it's probably appropriate. I guess my question, though, Senator Weaker, is the $125,000 for MDH for the purpose of continuing the prevention of violence in the healthcare program. It sounds like a lot of the programs are already in place in the hospitals. What else is the department going to do with that money when you already have the MOAB and the behavioral rapid response and the show of force? You already have programs that are already implemented. Exactly what are they going to do with that money, if you could tell me?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, the Senator number Reger. Was recommended by the department. I'll ask their representative to document the need.
Ms. Rydrick, the $125,000 one-time appropriation.
Yes.
Welcome to the committee.
Yes, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Diane Rydrick. I'm the director of the Health Policy Division at MDH. As you noted, the appropriation is a one-time appropriation to be used across two fiscal years. And as we thought about the work that needs to be done, we've been looking at what hospitals and other providers have been telling us. As Ms. Krinke noted, this is not just a hospital issue. This affects clinics. It affects long-term care and other settings. We've been working with many of those settings over the last 2 years on a violence prevention campaign. We just surveyed them recently to find out what their needs are in order to help them moving forward, and training was the number one thing they mentioned. So training where we would partner with law enforcement on de-escalation and response, training that we could go out into different regions of the state, videotape, webinar, make resources available on an ongoing basis. So that would really supplement what is happening within hospitals, but also spread to other types of organizations like nursing homes, clinics, potentially home care as well. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Rydrick. Any other questions? Senator Benson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Rydrick, help me put this in context. Is there other kinds of training that MDH does, safe lifting, food safety? Do you make that available? I'm just trying to see if this fits sort of in your wheelhouse.
Ms. Rydrick.
Yep, Mr. Chair, Senator Benson. We do training on a number of issues. Where I think this fits most closely is in our patient safety area. That's where the violence prevention work has grown out of in the last couple of years, is through our adverse health events program. Through that program, we do regional trainings every year on root cause analysis, on analysis of events and their causes. So we go to different parts of the state and do that type of training in partnership with MHA and other organizations. So we'd envision a similar model for this type of training, where we'd be partnering with other organizations and going out to different parts of the state to work on prevention.
And then Senator Carlson, you also had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll ask anyone who would like to answer. We talk about the prevention, which I think is great in this bill. We talk about the some of the training on safety and then de-escalation, but there's a piece that seems to me that needs to be additionally addressed, and that's the basics of disarming an agitated person, a person who in just a moment will go from compliant to suddenly dangerous. And I think we saw in that video that the nurses scattered, and I think the person went after one person with a pipe. Now, is there something that, and I'm looking at how the airlines do it with flight attendants. It's been 30 years that they've given flight attendants what they call the flight attendants call it Rambo training, and it's how to not just de-escalate, but how to disarm, how to hold a person safely, how to bring them down, where to grab them, that kind of a de-escalation that isn't just speech. It's more, you know, what are we going to do? And then also I'm wondering if there is going to be any devices that would be in the hospital that, for instance, the ability to tase a person who has gone violent. I'm wondering if there's anything like that that's considered in this training.
Mr. Chair, Senator Carlson, I'll ask Mr. Tollefson to respond. Of course, de-escalation guidelines, responses, that's included in sub 2C1, and a further amplification and training, et cetera, is a discussion in progress. I'm sure there may be capacity to tase at some places now, but again, that's proprietary. Mr. Tollefson.
So, and also, Senator Carlson mentioned the video that we, those of us that were on the Health Policy Committee watched, a very disturbing video with, a very confusing situation, and I think that, you know, a violence prevention plan as is created here and the training around it with the specificity of what it would be, this is the kind of the core of the attempt to make sure that we have a plan in place and that the workers know how to implement the plan and recognize situations. But if you have additional testimony, Mr. Tollefson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Carlson, we would agree exactly with that. There was an incident. One of our nurses just told me a story recently working in the NICU, and you might be very surprised where these acts of violence occur, but a father of an infant was becoming very upset and threatened the nurse and actually had a knife and said, if you don't save my baby, I'll kill you. And it was because there was an Army nurse, a former veteran, who was on duty, who had that de-escalation training as part of Army training, that was able to intervene and sort of address the issue right on. And that sort of training is exactly what we mean with de-escalation and all sorts of that safety plan in place, whatever it might be for each hospital, dependent on the needs of each hospital.
Senator Hayden.
Good. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just want to commend you, Senator Wieger, for bringing the bill forward, and then also Mr. Tollefson from the Nurses Association, along with Ms. Krinke. I think you guys are working well together, and I'm happy. I think that now we forge new ground with you guys, that we all continue to work very closely together, and those on this committee understand what that means. But to the bill, and one of the things, and I think it goes along with what I've heard Senator Sharon have said a lot about reporting and not reporting to the extent that we're trying to embarrass a hospital or show someone up, but actually reporting to understand the trend lines and to understand, and I think Ms. Krinke talked a little bit about that, hospitals are different. I've worked on these issues in each hospital, and I dare not to talk about some of the other bills we've worked on, but it has come out that each hospital has kind of different missions, different groups of people. Some are level one, some are specialized, some are rural. And so I think the ideal of trying to figure out where these incidents are happening, what type of patients that they're getting, how does that work? Who gets more patients that may have mental health issues? Who gets more patients that might have high trauma issues? I think for us to be able to continue to understand that, and then hospitals to develop individualized plans to deal with that, and frankly, for the legislature to understand that and then to target our training and even our resources there, I think would be important. Otherwise, I think if we do a kind of a one-size-fits-all, then we just get back into the same situation. It's probably not the best uses of our resources. So I would encourage you guys to continue the great work that I see you doing around the Capitol and work together to find a solution that really helps the folks that are working with some of our patients that are coming in for care. So thank you again for the great work.
Okay, and then I know Senator Wieger's presenting his omnibus bill next door, so we're going to have to kind of move along, and we got a big agenda. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, but just kind of getting concerned a little bit about the talk around this table. that we are usurping the hospital's ability to manage their business as they need to. And I think there was a big give here on paragraph E of the amendment that they would be informed to the collective bargaining unit and the bargaining representatives. So I'm a little concerned that we're headed towards this talk about the nurse staffing ratio and that we're going to micromanage out of this body what should be between the hospital and their workers. So I just want to state that for the record that this is getting very close to being not accepted if it goes any farther, as far as we as a legislature are going to start mandating what happens at our local hospitals, where they truly have the best interest for their patients and for their workers in mind. And I just need to state that. So,
and just one follow up, I don't want to leave that left Senator unresponded Sharon. To, and that is that I don't think that what we're talking about, at least what I heard from Senator Hayden, is about having the hospital determine whether the violence is related to some staffing issue. That is not what this is about. This is about a trend line and a determination of the circumstances under which violence is occurring to the people who work in any place, and that if we do not make this a collective set of data that we can follow those trend lines, we really are restricting our ability to look at trends and understand what, if anything, the state should do. So that's my objection to this. I think it falls short of accomplishing that. I will support it, but it doesn't go to what it is that I think the state needs in order to understand what's happening in workplace violence.
So, on the A6 amendment, and just to be clear, I think that the one remaining piece of disagreement can be found kind of on page 2, beginning on line 7, paragraph D there. Part of the annual review, the hospital must review with the designated committee the effectiveness of the plan, the most recent gap analysis, and the number of acts of violence that occurred and by unit. And the rubbing point is whether that data goes to the Department of Health or not. That's the last remaining piece of disagreement. And so I think we've heard differences of opinion from members of the committee, differences of opinion from the MNA and from the MHA, and I think there's good arguments on both sides. I would like to encourage the stakeholders to continue to work together. But on Senator Hayden's motion on the A6 amendment, is there any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Now we have the A6 adopted. So on Senate File 1071, is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to offer testimony either in support or opposition? Seeing none, Senator Hayden moves Senate File 1071 as amended be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion. On that motion, any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Weaver.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Just to a little housekeeping here, I think we're going to take up Senator Claussen's 988 next, and then Senator Sharon isn't able to be here tonight, so I think we'll go to Senate File 1311 following that. It's not clear whether Senator Sharon, Senate File 1576 will have a fiscal note or not. If it does, we'll try to get to that yet this morning. Hopefully we'll be able to accomplish that. If not, you know, we'll have to do that fluid thing. Maybe there's a co-author that could present it tonight. I'm not sure.
Senator Loria, somewhere I'm getting an indication that it's
ready. Close.
It's close to ready, yeah.
Well, I you know, sometimes those indications that they're close
mean next year.
Yeah,
yes,
go
I
for
understand.
A long time. So we're working as hard and as fast as we can. You know, from there, I do think that Senator Franzen is ready to go yet this morning, and Senator Hoffman's 1530 is ready to go this morning. We'll keep going as far as we can. We have to be out of this room by 11:30. We are able to come back in room 112 at 3:30 and continue our agenda, which should help us a great deal not be here right up until midnight. Hopefully members can accommodate that. So a little bit of housekeeping. Hope that's helpful. If anyone have any questions on something I may not have covered, I know there's a lot going on, and I do want to be as transparent as possible about the process. Anyone have any questions about what's coming up? Senator Claussen, Senate File 988. Welcome to the committee. And we have an A. There's no fiscal note. There is a fiscal note. It's not copied yet.
And Artie and Wicklund under.
How close is it to being?
I'll come back if I have to.
So. But it doesn't take very long to present the bill and the amendment. I mean, that's all right. Senator Sharon, are you ready with Senate File 1311?
Yes, we are.
The suicide prevention. I'm sorry, Senator Claussen. Copying issues. The fiscal note exists, but it's not on paper right now. And I think Senator Sharon's 1311 should be rather quick to get through. And so we will get to you and have the A3 amendment and the fiscal note associated with it prepared. Sorry, Senator Claussen. Senator Sharon, Senate File 1311.
Thank you very much. Senate File 1311 is the suicide prevention training bill. It has in it, first of all, I have an amendment. I need to delete Section 1 from 1311. It's an oral amendment.
And does that...
It changes the fiscal note by reducing the costs from the Department of Education by... It's on the fiscal note on page...
Senator Sharon moves to strike Section 1 in Senate File 1311. Any questions? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Same sign. Motion prevails. It looks like it gets rid of the $45,000 one time in the Education Department. Okay. So
what remains in the bill, Senator, is Section 2, which provides for two grants, a community-based grant program to provide evidence-based suicide prevention training to school staff, firefighters, peace officers, emergency medical staff, primary care workers, and others, and a second grant to provide for post-prevention training. This is for dealing with situations in which a suicide has occurred, for example, in the school, where we want to try to intervene early and not create sort of a copycat kind of a situation. Section 3 of Section 2 requires the commissioner with stakeholders to develop a plan that identifies methods to improve suicide risk data methods to help identify the scope of the problem in the state, identify the groups that are at high risk, tailor the prevention activities to those groups, and to monitor the effects of prevention. The fiscal note speaks to these requirements of the department, and the money is appropriated to the Commissioner of Health for those activities under Section 2. With me is Sue Abderholden, who can speak more clearly to the bill or answer any questions that you may have.
Ms. Abderholden, do you wish to offer testimony or just stand for questions?
Mr. Chairman, if I could just say about two sentences.
Sure.
I just want to point out
Please
why...
Please state your name for the record.
Oh, sorry.
You're a veteran. You know this. I didn't think I had to tell you.
Sorry, Mr. Chairman. I didn't have all my coffee this morning. Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. I just wanted to point out that back in 2001, we had roughly 400 people die by suicide. We're up to nearly 700 today. The biggest increase is actually among men. So just for example, in 2001, we had 22 men between the ages of 55 and 59 die by suicide. That went up to 60 in 2013. We had 28 men between the ages of 25 and 29 in 2005. It went up to 41 in 2013. So we are seeing those kind of large increases as well. And the other thing I wanted to mention is back in 2001, we actually had $1.1 million that was appropriated for suicide prevention activities. This last year, we had $98,000 that went out in grants, and we have a half-time person. So it was reduced substantially, eliminated at one point in 2005. And I think that we have, frankly, seen some of the results of not focusing on suicide prevention in Minnesota, and just wanted to point that out.
Thank you, Ms. Abderholden. Senator Sharon?
Well, I would just say that, Ms. Abderholden reminded me that there is an appropriation in the bill for a half time, to increase a half-time person to a full-time person. I think that I've been persuaded that that person at halftime is overwhelmed with the workload. It's the only position for suicide prevention, and that this is an appropriate request.
Is that the third appropriation that's the mental health first aid? Is that, no, which one is that?
It's $53,000 per year starting in 2016 for, if you look on page 7
of the fiscal note. Okay.
Under assumptions, it's talking.
So it's not in the appropriation, it's in the administrative costs to do it. Okay.
Yes, excuse me.
Good. Any other questions of members? Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just two questions, Ms. Apterholden. Where is this on your priority list? What priority is this? You probably will get this question quite a bit. I know your response, your mental response units are the number one. Where is this?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rosen, this, of course, is in the Health Department and not the Department of Human Services. This is our only request in the Health Department. And it's, I'm splitting hairs there, I know.
That was some good shucking and driving. We all it's our number one priority in the Health Department,
there you
right?
Go. Okay. That's all you need to know. Yes, Mr. Chairman. In the grand scheme of things, I think it is really difficult for me to say. There are a couple of key priorities in the Department of Human Services that we want to fund that would actually, build on what works in our mental health system. But I also feel that we have really neglected, frankly, our suicide prevention efforts. NAMI has received a small grant from the Department of Health, about $15,000 a year, and we have spent way more than that using grant money and just our general operating dollars because we get calls nearly every week for people wanting suicide prevention activities, whether it's the QPR, question, persuade, and respond, means restriction. We really get a ton of requests, and I think it's because it has become a bigger issue out there. So I know I didn't totally answer your question, but it was a hard one.
Chair.
Senator Rosen.
One other question, if you don't mind. Just, it always, Ms. Apterholden, the community-based programs on page 4, line 30, number 5, how does the Department of Health do that? I mean, how are they going to reach all those? It always kind of amazes me. How do you do that to get the proper training out throughout the state? Is it just information that's sent over the web? Is it a in-your-face type of training? Is it throughout the communities through Kiwanis? Or who's doing this?
So this is a grant program to community-based programs. So MDH would do a competitive bid, I'm guessing, that would encompass, to the extent they're able to offer grants, community-based programs that could do this would apply for them. But if you want to offer some additional insights, Ms. Apterholden.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I know, Senator Rosen, just with the foundation grants and our general operating dollars, I mean, we'll hold in different communities a QPR or a Safe Talk. We, put out press releases. We have a wide variety of people who attend. We get invited into the schools to provide that training so that they know as well. So it's pretty easy to hit them because people are really wanting this information.
Mm-hmm. And Mr. Chair, just follow up. Thank you. And Ms. Apterholden, how do we know that the entire state has a fair shot at the grant dollars and that it is being dispersed fairly throughout the state?
Ms. Apterholden.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rosen, the Health Department can probably respond better, but I know that when we receive our grant, we try to hit every region of the state so that we do have it accessible to anyone in the state of Minnesota.
Could we just...
Senator Rosen?
Mr. Chair, thank you. I'm just wondering if the Health Department can verify their intent to make sure that it's equally dispersed.
Is someone from the Health Department here to... Yeah, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thanks so much, Mr. Chair. Mark Kindy, Minnesota Department of Health, and I head up the Injury and Violence Prevention Program. Committee members, thanks so much. As Sue described, yes, we do work across the state with our halftime person, and we open the existing grants that we've had so that it's open competition for all. We use the approved, proven practices from that exists at the federal level in close affiliation, close partnership with Sue at NAMI and the other professionals in Minnesota. So wide open. What we do insist is that the evidence-based, proven practices are used, but wide open across Minnesota.
Thank you. Senator Benson, I think, and then Senator Brown, and then Senator Hayden. Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Sharon or Ms. Apterholden,
you're talking about a demographic of middle-aged men. A subset of that is the veterans community, who PTSD, TBI put them at risk. And I'm wondering, is this coordinating with the Department of Veterans Affairs? Are we getting silos in how we're handling that? Could you help me understand where this fits in that context?
Ms. Abderholden?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Benson, what we've seen is actually all the organizations really coming together. We, with the Department of Health and some grant funding, we were able to bring in just about 2 weeks ago a program that actually NAMI New Hampshire developed that's a best practice. That is the post-pension training. And we did have people who work with veterans who were part of that training, and they were very interested in working to bring that to the veterans community as well, so that when a veteran does take their life, that they're coming in and doing the appropriate thing. So I can't speak for the health department, although I do believe that they are part of the planning committee for the strategic plan. So I do see people working together on this issue.
Mr. Kendi?
Mr. Chair and committee members, yes, we are part of that planning team, part of the strategic planning, and have also worked to fund the postvention training as well.
Senator Brown?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And either to Senator Sharon or Ms. Abderholden or Mr. Kendi, if you know the response. But the appropriations to Commissioner of Health, $100,000 per year. How was that number arrived at?
Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Abderholden.
Senator, we just decided that bringing in a small number had a greater chance, and frankly, any increases in funding for suicide prevention activities would be great. So we were just doing a smaller number, but feeling that that could still make a huge impact.
And Senator Brown?
Mr. Chair, and partly to what Senator Rosen had been questioning, what kind of impact will $100,000 per year make? Can you give me some idea? This is a pretty large group of people, this community-based grants would be going out to on page 4 at the bottom that's listed. That's a large group of people. What's $100,000 per year? How much is that going to accomplish?
Ms. Abderholden.
Mr. Chairman, I can tell you that for an organization like ours, $100,000, we would just be infiltrating the state. Now, we're not, obviously going to get that much money because the grants are smaller. But I know even with our $15,000 grant, we have handed out literally thousands of lock boxes across the state of Minnesota to help keep young people safe and to keep them away from any, thing that they could use to harm themselves. I figure we have $98,000 now. We'd be able to double our impact if we were able to do that and really reach a lot of people. These are not expensive programs to deliver, but there is some cost to them. I don't know if you can add it.
Senator Hayden?
Good. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Sharon, thank you for bringing this bill forward. I was just sharing with Senator Fischbach that and I was just thinking about the booths that are out there, that I have a cousin who committed suicide about 2 weeks ago. He's an active duty Navy. He was a frog person. He worked on a frogman. He worked on the submarine, the USS Memphis. He's a proud graduate of Washburn High School here. And it has come to me lately that there was some undiagnosed mental health issues that some members of my family knew that I wasn't aware of, and that he went in and was able to hide that. He was an E7 and 27 years old and on his way to officer candidate school, and there was no indication of, other than people very close to him, that he even had issues. And he went home about 2 weeks ago and killed himself. As a matter of fact, I'm going to leave here at 12 o'clock to receive his body. And so this issue is real. It is something that we need to take very seriously, and with all of the work that we do here and understanding that I have of these issues, it was just something that I just wasn't aware of. He is named after me intentionally, and he has two children and one on the way. So I know that we often share these we all know somebody, and I just wanted to make sure that we share these stories and put a face on it, that this is happening at an epidemic rate. And often I would have hoped that I would have figured out earlier to see if I could give them some help, or as some of my family members are now telling me, that some of these issues were displayed when he was here, when he was in high school, before he even enlisted. And so if we had programs like this and we were able to do that, maybe we could have prevented Jeffrey from killing himself. So thank you again, Senator Sharon, for bringing this forward.
Very sorry for your loss.
Any other questions of members? Seeing none, is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to offer testimony either in support or opposition to Senate File 1311? Seeing none, Senator Sharon, move Senate File 1311 as amended be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS Omnibus Finance Bill. On that motion, any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All those opposed, same signs. Motion prevails. Now are ready for Senator Clausen as soon as we can get him here. He's just across the hall. He's coming over, so we will take up Senate File 988, which is probably in your packet right next to 998, so don't get all dyslexic on us. Senator Clausen, Senate File 988, welcome to the committee. Welcome back to the committee. This time we have the amendment and the fiscal note, and I do believe we are ready to go.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members, and thank you for the opportunity to present Senate File 988, a proposal to exempt providers of durable medical equipment from Medicare payment limits. Mr. Chair, I'd like to submit the A3 amendment for consideration.
Senator Sharon moves the A3 amendment to have it before us. It's a delete everything amendment, and this is not the first. This is not the first hearing, so it's not a author's amendment. So go ahead and describe it, and we'll adopt it before voting on the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, the A3 amendment removes rate increase language and specifies Medicare payment limit language for durable medical equipment. That's basically the gist of the amendment, Mr. Chair.
Okay. So the bill as introduced, and maybe I'll do a mea culpa here and say I was working on trying to figure out some costs that might be manageable to fit in our bill, and I had some different approaches, and this actually, as Senator Clausen described, removes the competitive bidding piece that was forced on us by the feds for good. But it does not include the rate increases that Senator Clausen was bringing forward. And when it was submitted to DHS, to fiscal note, it was submitted under my name, and DHS thought that this is what the direction Senator Claussen wanted to go and didn't continue work on the full-blown package. So, Senator Claussen, I appreciate your working with the amendment that I hoisted on you, I guess, inadvertently. And so that is what we have before us. But truthfully, this is best-case scenario anyway that might fit in a tough budget that we're trying to compile right now. So I appreciate you working on that. Again, this would eliminate that competitive bidding for good. That would we've been working on this for several years, but does not include the rate increase. And the cost is $2.3 million for the 16-17 biennium. Grows a little bit in the tails to just shy of $3 million. Any questions of members? Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you talked about the competitive bidding, but I'm wondering on lines 1.12 and 1.13, this eliminates paying providers below the Medicare rates. Is that correct? Currently, they can pay below the Medicare rate. Is that...
Senator Lori, members of the committee. My name is Cami Ozender. I'm general counsel with Pediatric Home Service and also representing the Midwest Association of Medical Equipment Services. Senator, correct. This language does look to strike the option to pay below the Medicare rate. At this time, there are no payments to DME providers that are below the Medicare rate, so this would not change the financial impact, but specifies the need to set rates above the Medicare competitive bidding reimbursement structure.
Okay. Senator Brown.
And Mr. Chair, and to the testifier, can you tell me how far below the retail rate the Medicare rate is?
Chairman Lori, Senator, if I may, I can speak to the reimbursement rate of Medicare competitive bidding below the current Medicaid rate, which alone is quite significant. The average rate is reduced by 45% across the board for all categories impacted, but also as much as 83% of below the current Medicaid rate.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions of members? Senator Claussen, did either of your testifiers wish to provide additional testimony, or are they here just for questions?
No, Mr. Chair, I think that they would like to provide some additional testimony.
Okay. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Senator Lori and committee members. My name is Debbie Harris, and I am from Eagan. And my husband and I have a young adult. His name is Joshua. He's 22 years old, and he was born prematurely, about 31.8 weeks, which isn't not that premature by today's standards. But he had a grade 4 brain hemorrhage, and subsequently his life depends upon a tracheostomy tube and a feeding tube. And he is given feedings 24 hours a day through a feeding pump. Much of his equipment is not covered by our insurance. We have military insurance. My husband was in the military for 34 years, and they follow the same rules that Medicare follows. And so for young people who depend upon this equipment, Medicare isn't really structured to accommodate them. It's good at what it does. It's really set up to accommodate older people who are maybe in the last parts of their lives, but not young people like Joshua who have a full life ahead of them, even with the support of the equipment. So Joshua he's quite small for his age, and so he has high muscle tone because of cerebral palsy. And he has a very short neck. My husband is a Marine, and we always joke that Marines just have a head and shoulders, no neck. And so Joshua gets that from him, I suppose. But he also has a difficult time with his tone. So when he would try to, for a long time, for many years, try to turn and look at us, he couldn't do it because of his tone and because he had a type of trach tube that was very standard and wouldn't allow him to turn his head without actually occluding his only airway. And so now he has a tube that is provided by a company that is equipped and knowledgeable to help with children like Joshua that's flexible, and it's a small piece of equipment like that has changed his life. So he can now turn and look at people when they speak to him. He can participate in the world around him. He can see the world more circumspectly. Also, he has a feeding tube that at one point was just a Foley catheter, a latex catheter that kind of hung out of his tummy. And for a lot of people with developmental disabilities, that is actually a risk because they catch a hold of it and pull it out. But now Josh has a low-profile button that attaches to a pump that feeds him. And prior to getting this many years ago, we had a caregiver in our home just kind of lay Josh down and pour in, before he had the pump and the proper tube, pour in about 16 ounces of formula into his tummy. And he has an extra small tummy, and he was a small child at the time, and he actually drowned in formula. And so it wasn't, he spent a few months in the hospital. They didn't expect him to live, and it was something that did not have to happen. When we did go home, we went home with knowledgeable caregivers and with equipment that could accommodate Josh's life and lifestyle. And so now he has a low-profile button and a pump that just evenly and strategically delivers the nutrition that he needs to survive. He's a very happy young man now. He participates in adaptive baseball in Burnsville, All-Stars. Season starts in about 2 weeks. And he enjoys his family. He goes to a fine arts program during the week, and he's a wonderful joy in our lives. And so I just wanted to give that as an example of how critical a net this is for us, because Josh is over 20 and has to use his access to Medicare, MA has become our safety net, and that's the only way that he can actually get the equipment he needs, because the other because Medicare doesn't accommodate that type of equipment. It just wasn't structured that way. So thank you so much for your time and listening to my story.
Ms. Harris, thank you for bringing your story forward. Ms. Ender, did you also wish to offer testimony, or are you for questions?
Just to speak briefly, as Debbie did, there are inherent differences in the Medicare and Medicaid programs. They're meant to serve different purposes and different populations. Under Medicare, the needs of the Medicare population aren't less important, certainly, but the needs of that population are more standardized, they're more routine, and they're simply more stable. In order to appropriately provide for the Medicaid population that has a more intensive need, Medicaid historically has matched that with adequate reimbursement in order to preserve the access to those services. And I'll just close by saying that the DME community meets those needs and has done that in a very cost-effective manner. If the Medicare rates were adopted, it's simply not sustainable for the industry community. But the needs of these children and disabled community won't go away. Unfortunately, they would be fulfilled by a higher-cost provider. So what we're looking to do is preserve the Medicaid reimbursement structure and asking not to have these devastating rate reductions, again, for the preservation of current access.
Thank you, Ms. Ender. Any questions of members? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify either in support or opposition to Senate File 988? So we need to adopt the amendment yet. So I believe that was a Senator Hayden motion. Mm-hmm. Senator Sharon moved the A3 amendment. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. So now we have Senate File 988 before us as amended. Senator Sharon moved Senate File 988 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion on the in the Omnibus Health and Human Services Finance Bill. On that motion, we did have a testifier come forward. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Hi, I'm Mark Hughes. I'm a former Minnesota State Council on Disabilities board member of 12 years, and I'm here today to testify on the durable medical goods portion of the bill. I'm really kind of disappointed, to be quite honest. at the way this was administered, because we now have Medicare involved. And before, we had 37 providers. We've gone down to about 4 in the metro area. None of them are really around where I work or where I live. And if you get the Medicare involved, you're going to get probably a Florida-made wheelchair. Well, you know, Florida's a nice state, nice to visit, but when you live in Minnesota, you need a durable good that you don't get. And we've had cases where a couple things have happened. People have gotten the wrong equipment. The equipment has fallen apart. One of the members on the mayor's committee in St. Paul, that did happen to on Rice Street, the front wheels fell off. We had to call the St. Paul police to get her a ride to try to get the wheelchair fixed on Saturday afternoon. And you don't have the freedom of choice or the freedom of service. And that's an important thing. And I don't think that this program was very well thought out. And I think that there's some changes to be made. If you look at it from a contractor or business person standpoint, they're looking for a 36% threshold there. If they're not getting it, they can't afford to do the business that we need to have done. And so we've actually got taken away from us. And if you think you're going to save money by Medicare running this program, then show me how. And believe me, I'll be around to find out what you're doing and how you're doing it. But right now, I'm not happy. And I think I'm a voice of many of the thousands of disabled folks here in Minnesota. The people in Minnesota aren't being served by this program well. And right now, I'll stand for any questions.
Mr. Hughes, you're not in favor of the amendment we just adopted. Is that correct?
Tell me what that is. I wasn't in the.
So the A3 amendment says that that Medicaid in Minnesota, and we can't set Medicare rates. So I mean, we aren't in charge of that.
Right.
And what this says is that in Minnesota, our Medicaid rates will not follow the Medicare standards. We're going to follow our historic Medicaid standards for setting the rates for durable medical equipment.
All right. So everything stays the same as it was?
Everything stays the same as it is today. We have extended this a couple of times. We've been trying to manage and see if we could figure out, you know, the feds changed the Medicare and instituted competitive bidding.
Yep, I understand that.
And it was a problem, and we've been trying to address it and trying to find a longer-term solution. We've come up with a solution each year to get through another year and continue the conversation,
right.
What we have before us right now,
right.
That we're about to vote on. But, I mean, I'm
right.
Glad you came forward.
We have to do something better. We're just not being serviced well at all. I think you have to have somebody locally handling the durable medical goods or the program won't work. And it's that simple. I mean, to have a national program and get the wrong equipment and things breaking down constantly. I've not had good luck with this wheelchair. I've gone through 5 sets of bearings. This wheelchair is not 2 years old. And I've been talking to Al Newman prior to this hearing. I'm going to trade this in as soon as I can because it's not servicing me. So the program we have now has to change. So whatever you can do for us, I appreciate it. But I'm not happy when Medicare is involved and we're dictated, we got to go to 4 places in the metropolitan area. It's not working. That's my point.
Thank you, Mr. Hughes.
You're welcome.
Any questions of members? Senator Claussen, Ms. Zender, any response or?
I'll just say, Mr. Chair, that we appreciate your work over the last 2 years in providing a temporary fix, and I think this will go a long ways in preserving the durable medical equipment and supply network that we have here in the Twin City area and throughout Minnesota and help independent living take place for many of our disabled citizens. So thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to offer testimony on Senate File 988? Seeing none on Senator Sharon's motion that Senate File 988 as amended be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Claussen. Next, we're going to Senator Franzen, Senate File 998.
you.
This is why we can't have nice things. Hence the no water on the floor. No, thank you.
It's too soon to laugh.
What's it?
It's too soon to laugh.
<It's not>.
Senator Franzen, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Senate File 998, it expands access to public health nurse home visiting program. This bill allows for the strengthening and expansion of the Nurse Family Partnership Program, an evidence-based and community health program targeted to serve first-time low-income moms and their babies with over 37 years of randomized controlled trial research providing its effectiveness. NFP clients are partnered with a registered nurse early in pregnancy and continue weekly and biweekly home visits until the child turns two. NFP clients receive the personalized care and support they need to have a healthy pregnancy, provide responsive and competent care for their children, and become more economically self-sufficient. The bill does three things to strengthen and expand the Nurse Family Partnership Program. It increases the Medicaid fee-for-service rate to $140 and provides a $1 million in one-time funding to support currently underserved areas. It also provides $2 million per year in ongoing funding to support programs to expand services. And it's also included, partially funded in the governor's budget. So with me, I have two other testifiers. With your permission, Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn it over to them.
Absolutely. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Chelsea Pearsall, and I work with the Nurse Family Partnership. Just briefly, early intervention through Nurse Family Partnership, or NFP, during pregnancy allows for critical behavior changes needed to improve the health and welfare of both mother and child. Research shows that prenatal to age two is the most important time period in brain development, with 80% of brain growth occurring prior to age three. The Nurse Family Partnership serves first-time low-income pregnant women starting early in pregnancy, prior to 28 weeks gestation, through the child's second birthday. Nurse Family Partnership is data and outcomes-driven. Data tracking and ongoing evaluation are built into programmatic funding and directly inform continuous quality improvement efforts. Independent analyses by the Brookings Institution and Washington State Institute for Public Policy have documented the NFP produces a positive return on investment for government and society. The RAND Corporation estimates a $5.70 return for every dollar invested in the program. A recent model developed by Dr. Ted R. Miller of the Pacific Institute for Research and Evaluation estimates that the cumulative cost to Medicaid will be approximately $180 per visit by the time the child turns 23 months in Minnesota, with additional cost savings accruing to Medicaid until the child turns 18. And with that, I'm going to hand it over to the next testifier. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Joan Brandt, and I am the Family Health Manager for St. Paul Ramsey County Public Health. I'm here today to testify in strong support of Senate File 998. We provide public health nursing home visits to pregnant and parenting families in our community who are on or eligible for medical assistance, and one of the models we use is Nurse Family Partnership, or NFP. Our current capacity to serve through NFP is only 300 families, about 20% of potentially eligible families in the county. So much is gained through the nurse and family relationship, working in the context of family and community. We see better birth outcomes, reduced infant mortality within the families we serve. When we're able to engage the families prenatally through our work with NFP, the playing field has been leveled and our birth outcomes and infant mortality rates are much better. Currently, we recoup less than half the cost of our visit through reimbursement for managed care and fee-for-service. We have to use local funding and federal grants to supplement these costs. We know that our services are saving the managed care organizations and medical assistance dollars because of our birth outcomes. Getting a baby to full term at a healthy birth weight certainly is saving significant dollars by avoiding the cost of a NICU. As such, we know that we are helping to improve HEDIS measures related to maternal child outcomes, such as birth weight, gestational stage, immunizations, and well child care, to name a few. The rate increase proposed in this bill will help with program sustainability, as well as for some communities, greater capacity. Additionally, in some communities throughout Minnesota, collaborations of counties have come together to provide NFP services. Supporting Hands is a model of 20 rural counties in southwest Minnesota that have come together under a joint powers agreement to provide services. They currently have a waiting list. Other counties have also expressed an interest in developing these collaborative service models, but it takes funding to develop the infrastructure for NFP implementation. The bill provides one-time funding to accomplish this. And lastly, as mentioned above, we and other organizations are able to serve only a small percentage of eligible families. Many agencies, including ours, have waiting lists for services, and the woman times out, goes past her 28 weeks of gestation before a slot on the caseload opens. The expansion dollars proposed in this bill would support increasing agency capacity in agencies where NFP is already implemented, but the agency is unable to expand without additional support. Thank you for your consideration, and I would ask for your support of Senate File 998.
Thank you, Ms. Brandt. Any questions of members? Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifier, if this funding were provided as proposed, how do you, to what percentage would you see that reducing the waiting list?
Ms. Brandt.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it would only increase our ability, because it would be statewide funding for current sites, it would only increase our capacity maybe 10%, depending upon the size of the grant.
Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifier, this is for at-risk families. Do most of these families have stable housing during that first 2 years of from pregnancy through the first 2 years of birth?
Ms. Brandt?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's a great question, and currently no. Stable housing is a significant, unstable housing actually is a significant issue of the families we serve. However, through this program, one of the things that we work hard to do is connect families to stable housing so that they can be successful.
Mr. Chair, one last question. If this funding were to go through, would you foresee if they had stable housing, that there would be consistent visits from the home-based nurse visits, or would they be erratic? Or kind of give me a picture of what that would look like.
Ms. Brandt.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, stable housing would greatly improve our ability to provide regular routine visits. Because of the unstable housing situation, the visits are much more erratic. But if you've got a person in a house or an apartment consistently, we see them consistently.
Thank you.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Brandt, you mentioned Supporting Hands in the southwest corner of the state, I believe 20 counties. Is that correct? I see here in the fiscal note that there is a one-time appropriation of $1 million for planning and startup grants. How did Supporting Hands become how did they get started without some kind of initiative? Was it just all the counties throwing some money in a pool? And
Ms. Brandt.
I can answer that question. It was a lot of local investment to start that program. There was also some federal funding that they received to add additional families and counties to that.
Senator Rosen.
So, Mr. Chair, thank you. And so we have not talked about the federal dollars. Is there federal dollars coming? And I have another question. Where is the federal funding with this?
Mr. Chair.
Please restate your name for the record.
Chelsea Pearsall. Senator Rosen. We actually heard today that the federal funding that we are currently receiving in the state was voted in the Senate at the federal level last night, and we will see a $400 million extension of the federal funds for the entire country that are coming in. We currently receive competitive funding through the feds to provide evidence-based home visiting services in this state.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen.
And Ms. Pearsall, how soon will you know what Minnesota will receive out of those federal
Minnesota,
funds?
Minnesota.
Pearsall.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, Minnesota actually received a grant award that was granted last month for this fiscal year, And then we will know more, I think, in the next year what the outlay will be for Minnesota. But we received $9 million over 3 years for our competitive grant. And previously to that, we were receiving $8 million per year for a competitive grant. So in overall dollars, it was a cut to the grant funding from the feds.
And Mr. Chair,
Senator Rosen.
Thank you. One follow-up. The $2 million that's appropriated for expansion grants, that would be a competitive RFP, I would assume Ms. Rosal or Ms. Brandt. And I guess, obviously, I'm a supporter of the bill, but there just seems to be some missing pieces as far as what's the goal, how many areas are already being served throughout the state, and with the federal dollars coming in, how is that going to supplant some of the dollars that are needed from the state?
So. Mr. Chair, I can also point members. There's a handout in your packets that has a map of the state, and current service areas around the state are the ones that are in color, and Ms. Purcell can actually add more to that. We're trying to expand it to other areas as well, but if the packet has that map, that's also helpful to illustrate where the current funding goes to.
Is this a map? I mean, does each of these areas have funding through that federal grant? I thought this was areas that had a program. I'm not certain each and every one of them receives a portion of that grant or not. Maybe they are synonymous, but I'm not sure.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, that actually, you are correct. Not all of those counties are receiving the federal funding. This is comprised of the map of the counties that are currently implementing the program. All of our programs are using blended and braided funding to help support this program, which can include the federal funding as well as MCH block grant, the TANF funding, and many of our counties, like the counties in Supporting Hands, are also using local tax levy dollars to supplement those programs.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Purcell, obviously there's some areas in the state that my district, Senator Sharon's district, that need some help. Is there some collaborative efforts with some of the, like, per se, Region 9 or Region 10 that would be part of this that could help with this competitive grant or expansion of a program? Where is the collaboration in this?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen. The $1 million in one-time funding would be for planning grants to let counties come together and start to plan around how they would implement the program.
So, Mr. Chair and Senator Rosen,
Senator Franzen,
that would, if your region of the state would be interested in participating, and they would competitively work to get a grant under that $1 million planning grant, one-time funding under this bill. So that is to expand it further to the white areas in the map.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question, Senator Franzen, is how do they do that? I'm not quite sure if it's just the human services that are getting together or if it is through a vehicle such as Region 9. How do they collaborate is how I'm asking. How are these counties going to get together? Who facilitates that?
Ms. Brandt, looks like.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, my understanding from Supporting Hands is that it's the public health, the local public health departments that have come together on a joint powers agreement. Started very small, just a few counties together, and I know that the current executive director of Supporting Hands is very willing to assist other counties and give tips in terms of how it happened with Supporting Hands. Just a few counties got together, local health departments wanting to do nurse family partnership, began to work together under joint powers, and other counties, adjoining counties, saw what was working and effective and came on board, and it is now built to a 20-county collaborative. Mm.
Any other questions of members? Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and again, disappointed in the fiscal note because I think this makes a difference. And if we look at the back of the Nurse Family Partnership handout. There are bullet points. There's a reduction in hypertension, a reduction in early delivery, reductions in emergency room uses, and yet this has to fight for dollars. And it is very hard for us to sit here and have an honest assessment when our fiscal notes reflect no savings. I know we're not supposed to dynamically score, but I have never understood the reasoning behind that. If you're going to have fewer emergency room visits, put it in here so that it's easier for us to make the argument going forward. So with that, Mr. Chair, I know this is Senator Franson's bill, but I would be happy to support it by moving it.
Senator Benson moves Senate File 998 be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion. Before we take a vote, is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to offer testimony either in support or opposition to Senate File 998? Seeing none, is there any further discussion of members? Seeing none on Senator Benson's motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Thank you,
Senator Franson. A little bit of housekeeping. We're going to come back at 4:30 instead of 3:30, as I suggested. And remember, I did say we were going to be fluid, and that's going to be needed. But 4:30 is the current target for coming back. Just in terms of where we're going on the agenda, we're going to take Senator Hayden next, and then Senate File 655, 12th on the agenda, and then from there, Senator Sharon, Senate File 1576. The fiscal note apparently was close, which was good. And then hopefully Senator Hoffman, Senate File 1530. And we'll probably recess at that point until 4:30 and come back and finish our agenda at that time. Senator Hayden, Senate File 655.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee members. For indulging me in moving the schedule around. Today I have Senate File 655, a bill to modify payments to the state's 17 FQHCs and 83 rural health clinics. Mr. Chair, I do have an amendment that reflects an agreement that has been reached by the Association of Health Centers in the Department of Human Services.
Okay. And the fiscal note is drafted to that amendment, correct? It does appear so. So this changes the effective date. And what else does it do? Does it? Oh, there it is, 1920. Okay. So this is the fiscal note is drafted to the A3 amendment. Any questions on the A3 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Good. Mr. Bill, Chair, Senator members, Hayden. I'm going to reintroduce you to Jonathan Watson of the Minnesota Association of Community Health Centers to further explain the bill, the amendment, and the agreement that has been reached.
Mr. Watson, welcome to the committee.
Great. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, my name is Jonathan Watson. I'm with the Minnesota Association of Community Health Centers. We represent the state's 17 FQHCs throughout the state. As the bill was originally introduced, what this was attempting to correct was for the patients that we serve that are dually eligible for both Medicaid and Medicare. These are seniors with very, very low income, so they're dually eligible. FQHCs serve about 2,000 or 2,100 of these patients per year. But in January 1st of 2012, there was a change in state law that essentially removed the copayment that the state was making on behalf of these patients. So prior to that, the Medicare agency paid 80%, and the Department of Human Services paid the remaining 20% copayment on behalf of the patient since they were dually eligible. Effective January 1st of 2012, the state did remove that 20%. As we originally introduced the bill, we are asking for our Medicaid rates on these 2,100 individuals, and this was higher than just simply adding back that 20%. And the reason we did that is we have a letter from CMS, the federal agency, of August of 2013, that does instruct the department to pay the FQHCs in that manner. The Department of Human Services has a fundamental disagreement with our association in terms of the content of that letter and the applicability. So rather than having a fight before you in front of a committee, we reached an agreement last week, which this amendment represents, where we would be just receiving that 20% co-payment back to the FQHCs. And I just also have to mention that it does affect the state's 83 rural health clinics throughout the state, which my association doesn't represent in any shape or form. So that is the point of the amendment. It does cost less than the original bill, the Senate File 655, was by having us pay our Medicaid rate. So that is the proposal.
Thank you for that, Mr. Watson. Any question of members? Seeing none, is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify either in support or opposition to Senate File 655? Seeing none, Senator Hayden moves that Senate File 655 as amended be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. On that motion, any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Hayden. What did I just say the order was?
Next to Senator Sharon.
Until 4:30 now. I guess I missed something. I think we need to do this
recess. 1576. Do we have copies of the Senator Sharon? Do we have copies of the fiscal note? I think that's where we're going. Okay, we do. Woo! That's a big one again, sleep. Senator Sharon.
Yikes, I'm getting a reputation for spending, big spender.
Yeah, you know, when spender. I mentioned that there was about over $1 billion before this committee, I haven't done the percentage, but it's a lot of it anyway.
Okay, thank you,
Senator Sharon.
I would be remiss if I didn't say that we all gasped at this fiscal note when it appeared, and I'm sure it's because we're pressuring people to do these that they've made significant errors in their assumptions, and we're going to have continuing conversations about that. With that, I will just indicate to you that this bill, in terms of its policy position, is moved through the Health Policy Committee. What we're talking about is trying to address a problem in which Minnesota's primary care payments rank about 47th in the country. The rates have only been updated a handful of times over the last 20 years, and for most services are about 20 to 30% lower than the Medicare rates. In 2013 and 2014, all medical assistance payments for certain primary care services that were provided by a subset of primary care providers were allowed a provision in the Affordable Care Act that bolstered the rates in recognition of the expansion of Medicaid, which Minnesota participated in, and the need for primary care services. And this rate increase, as a result of that expansion, was paid at 100% federal money. But that increase ended on December 31st, 2014. And in Minnesota, the increase resulted in a 36% bump of the primary care rates that have now reverted to the pre-ACA level. So this Senate file, if passed and funded, would reinstate and continue those payment rate equivalencies of the 2014 Medicare payment rate. And the increase is focused on office visits, primarily primary care office visits. I do have an amendment to the bill. It is the A3 amendment that I'd like to offer at this time. It's a delete all amendment that articulates more clearly how the payment for primary care services.
And the fiscal note is drafted to the A3 amendment.
Yes, it
so
is.
That is what we would have before us in the fiscal note. Any questions on the A3 amendment? Seeing none on Senator Sharon's motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
So with that, I have testifiers here who can answer questions. They may want to make a brief statement to you, understanding the time limits. But in general, my comment would be that we need to do this if we expect our provider community to continue to participate in medical assistance and Minnesota care programs.
So if we don't do this, we're going to have a mass exodus? I mean, that's a little scary because I didn't save $132 million.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Eric Dick with the Minnesota Medical Association, also here on behalf of the Minnesota Academy of Pediatrics and the Minnesota Academy of Family Physicians. I think I share Senator Sharon and the committee's sticker shock. This is a number that is significantly above what earlier estimates since withdrawn appeared to be. So I think I, like you, have just received the fiscal note here in the last moments, and I'm interested in taking a closer look at the numbers and the assumptions. As Senator Sharon does note, we in Minnesota rank 47th in terms of where we sit for MA payments to physicians and other primary care providers. Other states have seen fit to enact this increase. 15 other states, in fact, and as diverse as Iowa, Maryland, Alabama, Mississippi, and Colorado. And again, we are eager to look at the assumptions of the fiscal note, but this remains very much an issue of interest to Minnesota's physician community.
Thank you, Mr. Dick. And Senator Sharon, you had one additional testifier?
Yes, Maureen.
Welcome
Mr. Chair,
committee.
Members of the committee, my name is Maureen O'Connell, and I represent the Advanced Practice Registered Nurse Coalition. And I'm just here to voice our support for this bill and to share in everyone's sticker shock.
And I think we're all trying to read this quickly and absorb it. I do think that we do have somebody from the department who could help us absorb it more efficiently. If somebody wanted to come forward and try to describe what we're seeing here, I see that it does add physician assistants and APRNs to the list of eligible providers. Haven't quite gotten to the point where I see.
Senator Lurie, they were before also covered, and
okay.
That's not an addition, so
well,
I don't think they can offer an explanation.
Let's bring DHS up and. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Hi, Patrick Holtman with the Department of Human Services. Thank you, Mr. Chair. What we did here was we just looked at the percentage increase that was applied to these categories of service as spelled out in the Affordable Care Act. This is the sort of a continuation of what was we received 100% federal funding for between January of 2013 and December of 2014. And this adds the advanced practice registered nurses who were not part of this in 2013 and 2014. I'm looking at Julie Marquardt to just confirm that, and she's nodding her head.
There seems to be a matter of disagreement about that. I think Senate counsel was describing to me that the way it was handled in 2013 or 2014, it was that APRNs and physicians' assistants under the collaborative agreement, the supervision of a physician, were authorized, and this removes that requirement of under the supervision of, and is where the expansion maybe occurs, so that provision of services that didn't get this bump in 13 and 14 would now get it under this language, and that's where some of the additional cost, I don't know how much yet. Ms. Marquardt?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, my name is Julie Marquardt with the Department of Human Services.
Microphone right up to you.
Julie Marquardt with the Department of Human Services. And the expansion actually comes under the provisions of the Affordable Care Act. The APRNs and physician assistants had to attest that they had to go through a process where they had to attest, and we were required to verify that 60% of their visits were in these primary care and vaccine services. This doesn't require any of that attestation. So as as it's drafted right now, all APRNs and all physician assistants, regardless of whether they do that much primary care or not, are entitled to the increase. So that's really the expansion that's occurring.
So, but as I read the language, it actually, I do kind of scratch my head, because paragraph A says payment for certain primary care services as rendered for the period in the ACA shall be made in accordance with 1902A13 of the Social Security Act. So to the extent that these payments are beyond what's in accordance with the Affordable Care Act, it seems to me that this language wouldn't expand how you pay. I mean, I'm just trying to construct it, you know, a plain reading on the fly. Sometimes dangerous, but Ms. Marquardt?
Mr. Chair, the services are very generic services. It's evaluation and management services. They can be done in a primary care setting. They can be done as not primary care. So the ACA laid out both the services that the federal government considered to be primary care, but then it also laid out requirements for providers. So what this bill did was take the services, but then said it applies to these providers.
Okay.
So the way that's being, you know, that we are seeing that is, it's this group of providers. It's different than the ACA, because the ACA actually included other physicians as well, who we didn't include in this. General practitioner physicians who are not specialists who would attest to that same thing were also entitled to the increase.
So 1902A13 of the Social Security Act is in regard to the payment increase, and it says there will be a payment increase, and we're changing the list of providers. So that's not the section of the Affordable Care Act where the list of providers that are allowed to get the increase is. We're making our own list of providers and hooking them up to the piece that relates to the payment made in accordance with. That's what you're saying, basically?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. The services were, nothing was done to alter the set of services. What was done with the new language was to actually limit the providers, but then it actually expanded a category of providers.
Okay. Senator Benson, you had a question? Other questions of members?
Excuse me?
Senator Sharon.
If you asked me a question, I missed it.
No, I was asking, we didn't have any questions of other members, so if you have additional thoughts.
Well, I think that we will continue to have a conversation about this
yes.
with the department, and that we will be discussing and challenging the assumptions that they're making.
Okay. Well, hopefully the discussion was helpful. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to offer testimony either in support or opposition to Senate File 1576? Seeing none, Senator Sharon moves that Senate File 1576, as amended, we did adopt the A3, correct? As amended, be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. On that motion, any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Sharon.
Thank you.
And now we have Senate File 1530. Senator Hoffman is... he's close. And we do have another 37 minutes. It'd be good to get one more done.
Who's we?
11
o'clock. Who's we?
We, the girls, women.
The girls, the women?
Yes. Invited.
Do you want to recess now then?
How many bills do we have left? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
That's
we
true.
Have 5 bills.
Listen.
Members, do you want to just, you know what, I'll take the pulse of the committee. Should
so
we?
When you leave, I'll leave.
We do this one and then.
Senator Hoffman. Senator Hoffman, Senate File 1530, and after this we'll recess whenever we're done. We should be done a little before advance of 11:30 and plan to come back at 4:30 in room 112, and we will have 1, 2, two, three, four bills to work through this evening. Senator Hoffman, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Feel like a ping pong ball this morning between 107 and 112, but it's nice to be sitting down with at the table. With me at the table is Buck Humphrey and Jeff Lindu, who is president-elect of the Minnesota Pharmacy Association. Pharmacies are the primary place for Minnesota patients to go for prescription medications, and pharmacists, you know, provide health information and services to help folks manage those medications as they seek care for illness. What Senate File 1530 is, I deem the Patient's Choice of Pharmacy Act would provide patients with the right to choose which pharmacy they have their prescriptions drugs filled. I'm going to pause for a second and let you know that this also affects members of this body, including myself. Monday, my daughter missed school because she didn't have her appropriate bandages for a wound that she has, and the only place I can get those bandages is to drive to St. Louis Park to the hospital to get the bandages when I have three prescription pharmacies right in my backyard. So instead of me being on time for a hearing and my wife being able to go to work, and my daughter actually missed school, so there was an effect that I just wanted to let you know. Personally, it happened to me once again this week. But pharmacies are the primary place that we go for prescriptions. This Choice of Pharmacy Act provides patients like me and the rest of us to choose which pharmacy they want to have our prescription drugs filled. Increasingly, we're being mandated by the PBMs to either have our prescriptions filled via email or through mail order or through a specialty drug pharmacy, as opposed to be able to choose to have prescriptions filled at a local community pharmacy. So I believe patients should be able to choose to have these specialty drug prescriptions filled locally with their community pharmacist, as long as, and here's the kicker, this is important because this is a big part of this Senate file, is that the pharmacy is willing to accept the same reimbursements and other contract terms and conditions as the PBM specialty pharmacy. Pharmacists now, they're not asking for an additional payment. There's different incentives and different plans. And I know there's a fiscal note, Mr. Chair and members, and I do have lots of questions regarding that, but you know, it is my intent to hopefully work between now and Friday, because I really question, Senator Lori, I question how, when in the Commerce Department I get a senator, a Republican senator and a Democrat senator really saying that this looks like it could be a cost savings, if nothing it should be neutral. And we like that word neutral, especially when it comes to revenue and budget. So when I saw this, I was a little taken back, like I heard Senator Sharon say in the last testimony, was like, oops. So I would just have some serious questions that I would hope that you, Mr. Chair, would give me and the rest of us some time to figure out. So with that, here's Dr. Lindu.
Mr. Lindu, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Jeff Lindu. I work for Thrifty White Pharmacies. We are a Minnesota-based, employee-owned pharmacy organization. I've been with Thrifty for a little over 40 years, and I am a pharmacist. And as Senator Hoffman mentioned, I'm also the president-elect of the Minnesota Pharmacists Association. This bill is really about patient choice and continuity of care. As the senator mentioned, many plans are moving to a structure where there are either financial incentives or mandates for patients to get their medications from a mail-order pharmacy or from a specialty pharmacy, which is the majority of the time also mail order with no direct contact with the patient. And there are many patients who are fine with that. There are some patients who even prefer the convenience of getting their medications through the mail. However, for many other patients, they prefer, or maybe for health reasons, need to work with their local pharmacist to manage and coordinate all of their medications, not just the segment that they might be getting from their local pharmacy. And this bill is about allowing those patients to have the opportunity to work with their local pharmacist for all of their medication needs. When a patient requests the opportunity to work with their local pharmacy, this bill would prohibit a health plan or a pharmacy benefit manager from excluding that pharmacy. And again, as the senator mentioned, if the pharmacy agrees to accept the same reimbursement that is being paid to the mail order pharmacy or the specialty pharmacy, and if the pharmacy agrees to and is able to meet all of the terms and conditions of that contract. So again, we're not looking for favors. We're not asking for our team to have four outs. This is assuming that the local pharmacy can and will accept the same reimbursement and provide the same services. I'll point out all of our surrounding states have some form of similar patient choice medications. North South Dakota, South Dakota was just done by referendum last year. Iowa and Wisconsin all have some form of freedom of choice legislation that has been in place for varying lengths of time. We also just got the opportunity to look at the fiscal note. I'm very surprised. I've looked at some of the assumptions. As I said before, I'm a pharmacist. I'm not a legislator. I'm not an attorney. So I'm not used to looking at these things. But some of the assumptions are very surprising to me. There have been many studies that have looked at the impact of freedom of choice laws in various states, and the results of those studies are all over the board. South Dakota, when they did their study, they actually found some situations where it appeared that it lowered total health care costs. I'd also like to point out to the committee what doesn't appear to be in here is the potential savings through a greater continuity of care with the patient's local pharmacist being able to work with and manage all of a patient's medications. In many situations, when the patient is getting other medications from another source, the local pharmacist doesn't even know what those medications are, doesn't even know that the patient is on those. So again, would ask that you support Senate File 1530 for the sake of patient choice and continuity of care.
Thank you, Mr. Lindu. Mr. Humphrey, did you have additional testimony, or are you here for questions?
Mr. Chair, members, just for questions. I represent the Independent Pharmacy Cooperative, which is over 100-plus independent pharmacy owners in Minnesota.
And your name?
Sorry, Hubert Humphrey.
Questions of members? Seeing none, I believe there are others who probably wish to testify. I will ask if anyone else in the audience wishes to testify either in support or opposition to Senate File 1530. I was guessing we'd draw one or two on that. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Dave Dietrichs, and I'm with Express Scripts, a pharmacy benefits manager that is headquartered in St. Louis, Missouri, but has a large facility in Bloomington, Minnesota. And I'll keep my remarks fairly brief due to your time constraints, Mr. Chair. We provide the prescription drug benefit for 85 million Americans, and our clients include Fortune 500 companies, labor organizations, health plans, as well as government entities. Our largest contract is with the United States Department of Defense, so all of our nation's military personnel, both here and around the world, receive their prescription drug benefit from Express Scripts. Our mission is simply to make the use of prescription drugs safer and more affordable, and we are here today in opposition of this bill. Any willing pharmacy legislation limits our clients' choices as they design their benefit for their beneficiaries. There are over 69,000 pharmacies in this country. And just to give you an idea about how many that is, if you were to take all of the McDonald's in this country and all of the Starbucks in this country and then add that number together and triple it, you would still have more pharmacies. So of the 69,000 pharmacies in this country, my company contracts with over 65,000 of them. And the ones we don't contract with are for very good reasons. There are either problems with fraud, waste, and abuse, and we don't want to be mandated to contract with them, or simply there's an oversaturation of pharmacies, particularly in urban and suburban areas. A great example in Senator Franzen's district, there is a crossroads at 70th and Xerxes, and on three of the four corners there are pharmacies. And there is a Cub Foods two blocks away that also has a pharmacy. You have four literally within a two-block range. So sometimes our clients will ask us to create smaller networks of pharmacies so that there is a lower reimbursement rate, however, more guaranteed foot traffic into those pharmacies. This legislation would take away that option. This also has an impact on mail. There is a difference in cost, usually, for our plan sponsors and how they define their benefit. Usually there's a cost differential between mail and retail pharmacy to get your prescriptions filled, and we would hate to see that option taken away from them as well. And finally, regarding specialty pharmacy, we have specialty pharmacies inside of Express Scripts. They are centers of excellence that are staffed by physicians, other clinicians, specialty pharmacists, as well as nurses that handle the special care and administration for some of these very high-cost acute drugs. Great example is hemophilia. There are several thousand sufferers of this terrible condition across the country, and there are some patients that have a certain treatment therapy regimen, and there may be only five of them in the entire country. So it helps to have centers of excellence or even doctor's offices where you can receive the administration of these drugs. Just finally, in conclusion, and we've mentioned this before in past testimony, and I think it bears mentioning again, if there are pharmacies in this state that want to participate in our networks, they simply just need to fill out an application. And if they have the proper credentialing and meet the proper requirements, we will include them inside of our network. And so with that, I'll conclude my testimony, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Diedrichs. And I see an additional. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Bentley Graves. I'm the Director of Healthcare and Transportation Policy for the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Employers provide health insurance to the majority of Minnesotans, and as an organization that represents employers of all sizes across the state, we approach questions of healthcare policy with a particular eye towards costs, and that's what we've done in this situation as well. Initially, I had many of the same questions that Mr. Lindu raised about how this might impact costs, given the fact that it seemed to allow more choice for consumers. But in looking at this further, I learned that this is an issue that CMS at the federal level also looked at doing just about a year ago. And in the process of receiving comment on that move to move to any willing pharmacist in the Part D program in Medicare, they received fairly comprehensive feedback from the Federal Trade Commission. And I have a copy of that there here that I want to just highlight a couple of pieces of, but I also want to note that this is also mentioned in the fiscal note, as well as a couple of the studies cited here. But in commenting on the CMS proposal to move to any willing pharmacy, the Federal Trade Commission said the proposed any willing pharmacy provisions threaten the effectiveness of selective contracting with pharmacies as a tool for lowering costs. Requiring prescription drug plans to contract with any willing pharmacy would reduce the ability of plans to obtain price discounts based on the prospect of increased patient volume, and thus impair the ability of prescription drug plans to negotiate the best prices with pharmacies. It also noted that any willing provider and freedom of choice laws can make it more difficult for health insurers, plans, or pharmacy benefit managers to negotiate discounts from providers, resulting in higher costs. If plans cannot give providers any assurance of favorable treatment or greater volume in exchange for lower prices, then the incentive for providers to bid aggressively for the plan's business by offering better rates is undermined. And a couple of conclusions that it drew from this was that any willing provider and freedom of choice provisions can therefore undermine the ability of plans to reduce costs. This is likely to result in higher negotiated prices, ultimately harming consumers. And finally, these restrictions on competition may result in insurance companies paying higher fees to providers, which generally lead to higher premiums and may increase the number of people without coverage. And I'll close, Mr. Chairman, by just referring to a few of the studies referenced in the FTC piece to looking at the impact that this has had on states that have these laws. They cite three studies here, all of which indicate higher costs in those states. Two of these studies, I think, are also cited in the fiscal note. So with that, I'll leave it for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Graves. I guess to summarize, our first two testifiers and Senator Hoffman think this fiscal note is high, and you two think that it's either accurate or maybe even low. And we're going to have the fiscal note is fairly recent. We're going to have further discussions with stakeholders to try to see if the assumptions are correct and it's doing what the author intends, and so this will be another of those works in progress, and if we have further refinement of the fiscal note, we can accommodate that as we move forward. Does that sound about right, Senator Hoffman?
Mr. Chair and members, absolutely. You know, anecdotally, I can tell you it's a system that has caused lots of stress in my life and in my family's life, but I'm just one person. However, when you start to really look at, you know, the intent of when we talk about patient-centered care, family-centered care, with primary care, coordinated, comprehensive, collaborative health systems, to me, this is a no-brainer. And to hear about how this thing they're asking, what they're asking for is to just play by the same rules, just to allow that family-centered care within a small town or within. Why should I have to? I live in Champlin. I got to drive to St. Louis Park, 35 miles one direction, stand in line, wait to get a simple Band-Aid where I could easily get it either at Cub Pharmacy, Target Pharmacy, or Walgreens. Again, it's not about me, but I can definitely empathize with what's going on with the need for this, and that's why I question the validity of this bill at 26%. It just seems too high for me. So, Mr. Chair, I would appreciate that to have this bill laid over and give us a couple of days to work this through.
Any further questions of members? Seeing none, is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to offer testimony either in support or opposition to Senate File 1530? Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Twyla Braze. I'm president of Citizens Council for Health Freedom, and I recall that I had wanted to testify in support of this bill in Commerce Committee, and so I'm glad that I'm still here to testify in support of it here. I just want
on
to
HHS finance provisions, not on commerce provisions, hopefully.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Yes. So I just want to say that in support of this bill, that one of our concerns has been within the state of Minnesota, the loss of options for people besides managed care organizations. And what this does with the managed care concentration in the state of Minnesota is also concentrate other corporations in concert with them, such as the PBMs. So any willing pharmacy could actually open up the market, allow more competition, allow all of those four pharmacies and each corner to actually compete with each other to keep the prices down, just like there's a McDonald's and a Burger King and everything else all together in the same area for fast food. So we also want to say that the state laws that have been added here to expand what a pharmacist does provides patients with local support and questions about their prescriptions. So we do support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Brace. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to offer testimony on Senate File 1530? Seeing none, Senator Eakin moves that Senate File 1530. Is there an amendment? Be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS Omnibus Finance Bill. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. We have four bills remaining on the agenda. We will take those up in room 112 beginning at 4:30. With that, we stand in recess. Thank you, members and public.